Well, today is Thursday, January 16th, 2020, and I'm here with Joy Block. And Joy, I wonder, so that we can get the levels adjusted on the microphone, though I'm not going to do it, but maybe somebody will do that on the digital end. If you could spell your first and last name and your birth year for us.
All right. Well, J-O-Y, and then my last name is B-L-O-C-K, Block. Both of them are very easy. I was born in 1983.
Great. And I'm seeing levels jumping all around in the middle, so we're going to just assume that that's good.
Good.
It seems good to me. It seems good to you. So I wonder if we could begin maybe by learning about where you grew up, who your parents were, and who your parents are, and your siblings, if you have any.
Yeah. Well, I was born in Ithaca, New York, where my dad was going to graduate school at Cornell and my mom was teaching middle school. And then when I was about three, I believe, we moved to Champaign, Illinois. So that's where the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign is located because my dad got a job there. And then that is where I grew up until I went to college. So, I come from a family, at least my parents are educators. My dad's a professor of computer science, and he loves the programming side of things, but he's also just a really good teacher. For years, we wondered what my dad was like in the classroom, because we only saw him at home, right? And my brother, when he went to college, took a class with my dad, and we discovered my dad was just always the professor. So like, he was the professor of the classroom, and then he came home, and then we knew him as the professor at home, too. So that's my dad, and he, I think I said, does computer programming or computer science. And then my mom taught middle school before I was born. She got her college degree in education, and when I was born, she stayed home to care for me and became a mom and a homemaker. And so she's always sort of applied that educating experience to her kids, which was a pretty big plus growing up because we got training when we got home as well. But she tended to make it more fun than what we got at school.
Did she teach in Ithaca and in Urbana?
Not in Urbana. So she just taught in Ithaca. And then once we grew up, she started like substitute teaching. But didn't ever go back to teaching full time.
So I wonder maybe if you could say something about how your dad like was the professor at home and in the classroom. Is there a way in which that trait that
he loves to discourse on things, right? So and he's a huge reader. He'll read on every topic. In fact, I think probably some of my love for history comes from him just because he would read a lot of history and talk about it. And it's fun to have these conversations with him, but lots of times he's the one that has the knowledge and is telling you about it. So it's been a little bit funny sometimes now that I have gone to graduate school for history, holding my own in the conversation, just because like that's very much who he is. And in fairness, there's a ton of books that I didn't ever have to read because he gave me a full synopsis of them. So yeah, that's kind of who he is. My husband, Steven, his dad is also a professor. And so they're really funny when they get together because they're like all professorial with each other. But my dad is really academic, loving to learn. He loves to work on computer programming and discuss it with people. We'd have as grad students in our house a lot. And my parents had a pretty sort of traditional gender roles in marriage, so that allowed my dad to really be able to focus at the university and on his students and his work. And it gave my mom sort of free rein at home. So she got to be the one who had the final say on a lot of things. I can remember, you know, as a kid, you're trying to play your parents against each other, right? And so we'd go to my dad asking if we could get sweets or whatever. And he would always be like, no, your mom's the one who's in charge. Like, go ask her. I'm not stepping on her toes there. So it was, I think, sort of empowering for my mom, too, to be able to have that kind of authority. So, it worked really well for them. And it created a really stable home while I was growing up, too. I could tell, like, my parents really love each other, and it was working well for them. So I am oldest, and then my sister Grace is 4 years younger than me, and my brother Caleb is 8 years younger than me. And let's see, my sister has become my best friend, partly because my cousins are on, like, not any close to our age, right? So we would always hang out together, and that would cause conflict. But my mom would always tell us that your sister could be your best friend. So you really, you know, make sure you invest, because it could create, like, dividends down the road, right? So that's really good. She is in many ways very different from myself. But ironically, we both ended up getting into Asian studies and immigration interests in roundabout ways. She did it through studying diplomacy and now works in DC. So, and then my brother got all the computer science genes in the family. And that's what he majored in. He went out to California to work in computers for a while, and now is back in the Midwest doing computers still. So, that's been a fun, seeing how we sort of play out things, learning from our parents, but then taking things our own direction.
Yeah.
So I got almost all the education genes, though. So.
But maybe jumping ahead to a question that I might have asked later, but just, I guess, following the conversation. Talking about having a family, do either of your siblings have kiddos, and do you maybe see glimmers of that family propensity for education in the way that your siblings interact with their kids or your kids?
Well, so my younger brother got married and had kids first, and his wife is very much of invest in home and the family and kids development. So, she's just done some excellent work in training them. They're really smart. But I think my brother has helped with that, because he's really invested in family as well. But I'm not sure. Like, he does managing a lot. Like, he enjoys that. But I'm not sure that he's really gotten into, say, training in his company, which would be kind of the teaching aspect. My sister hasn't had any kids yet. She did, I'm trying to remember if she got a Boren or if it was like the Hayes or something. Which is the one that you go to the State Department? Not you go to the State Department, yeah, but you have
that's,
options.
That's the Boren Fellowship for graduate students.
I think
students.
She must have did done a Boren then. But she was in Taiwan for a year. It wasn't a research one. She was doing... she was teaching. Maybe it was
that could have been a Fulbright U.S. program.
She was teaching in a middle school, and it confirmed, I think, that she didn't want to do it long term, but she was surprised at the kind of, you know, ways of thinking, skills she had. When I'm not sure how much of it is our parents sort of teaching, some of it I probably was just like, I also taught my siblings to do that kind of stuff. So I can remember playing as kids together. And one of the things I would do back in the early years of Macintosh computers, I would like create these little worksheets of addition or subtraction. And then I think my brother first learned addition and subtraction off of my worksheets. But it was like him and the stuffed animals, right? And so my sister and I would play these teaching the stuffed animals and our little brother games. So that, that was kind of one of the things we did growing up.
So we talked, I guess, a little bit already about an early predilection for teaching, an education, you know, that you may have had in your interactions with your sister and brother. In your own, like, elementary school, maybe what was it like as a student? What subjects did you excel in, or maybe that you really, really liked early on?
Yeah. So I, me and my siblings went to the Christian school that was in town, Judah Christian School, non-denominational. And when I started, it was still pretty small. And by the time I graduated, my senior class was the last one that had only one class per grade. Maybe the second to last. But so it had expanded considerably over those years. But I started in kindergarten, and it was all kind of in the same building. And I remember the building expanding as I went through it. So I started in kindergarten in the elementary school wing, right? And then the elementary school kind of spread into another wing. And so I did that. And then middle school, we moved up into the middle school, high school wing. But then by the time I got to high school, there was a new wing built on. And so we moved into that. Anyway, so I have always loved school, and which I think is often how teachers have experiences. I love learning, and I read fairly early on. I am the kind of person who enjoys standardized tests. They're rare, but I always found it not something that you need to like be stressed out and prepare for, but like apply all the things you know. Go.
That, so you like that challenge.
Yeah, and they're kind of logic puzzles too, right? Like they are concepts that you have to study, but then it's like, can you figure it out whether you know this stuff or not? Because oftentimes there's the words that you can focus on if it's always or never, or things like that, that you can like cross out a whole bunch of them in your brain, especially for multiple choice, right? While you're going through. And I just, that was always fun. I guess I excelled at school. I was usually in the top of my class, and I just had fun with it. I loved asking questions and thinking through things. When I was in middle school, I remember I did an elective both years where I was like a TA for an elementary school classroom. Recently on Facebook, I saw this now adult man with a child who I was like, I taught him to read in third grade. So yeah, it's been something I think for a while that I've been enjoying. And I knew for a long time that I wanted to teach. I just had to figure out what it was going to be. So while I was good at many of the things, some of them were just a lot more fun and came naturally to me. So I was trying to decide at one point between history and English. And I love writing and I love reading, but I didn't like analyzing literature. So I think if English had been more about writing, that would have been of a lot more interest to me. But in the end, history just seemed like the thing that you could study everything through. So you couldn't study scientists historically, or literature historically, or music historically, or math historically. It encompasses all those different areas. And I had a really great history teacher in high school, same one for all 4 years. And he just did a great job of cultivating a desire for scholarship. He was pretty scholarly himself. He liked to say that if he hadn't met his wife, he would probably be a monk, because he just loves that sort of learning and quietness. And ironic that he became a high school teacher. But Mr. Williams was really, really helpful in that way for me to appreciate those things. And some stuff, like my senior year, we did a history of philosophy class, which you don't really get very often.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like a very typical high school course.
Yeah. Now, so it was a Christian school, so it was, explained as this is a world views class. Our students are going off into the secular college system, right? And so we want them to think about ideas while we can still help them think through the ideas, right? So it was very Christian, sort of evangelical based in that way, but still it just offered all sorts of ways, or maybe because my teacher just did a great job with it and allowed us to think through it in ways that were also connected to our faith, but would sort of like open us to a lot of things. And I think that was one thing I really appreciated about the Christian school I went to. Sometimes private schools and Christian schools are really focused on rich people. And my school had some, but then they had like the people who lived in the trailer homes and whose parents worked in factories. And so it was just this wide array. And it was also, because it was non-denominational, it was, at least at a Protestant level, pretty ecumenical. And so we had to process when somebody believed something very strongly that was different than what we had. And often found reason behind it in the same book that we valued, right? Mm. So that was, I think, a really helpful thing in my development, both as a like intellectual and as a Christian, so together.
Did a lot of the students and families associated with the school go to some of the same churches? Was there like a really big diversity in the religious homes, the religious communities that?
So they were like the popular churches, right? So the evangelical conservative community in Champaign, Urbana is pretty big, and there's a lot of churches. So it's funny to look back from like when I was in kindergarten to 12th grade, there were like, it changed what was the cool church over those 18 years or whatever. But there was a lot of people who didn't necessarily go to the cool ones at the given time. I was one of those. So my family went to a Christian Missionary Alliance church. And it's not a particularly big denomination in the States either. But it started as a parachurch organization that was doing missions in other countries. So it's actually larger internationally than it is in the U.S. And so I lived in the university town. We had a bunch of internationals at our church. And then going to this school that had sort of a, I'd say a reasonably wide range. It was still Protestant, right? There was a Catholic high school that got built sometime while I was there. And so before that, there had been a few Catholic students who went to the school, and they sort of all migrated once that happened. But I know my history teacher, once again, was really admired Catholics a lot. And so I avoided some of the problems that can come in the Protestant-centric social groups. So, yeah. So, where was I? I wrote a bunch of things down. Oh, I was going to say a few other things that I did.
Yeah.
So, I really liked school, but I also was involved in things that were outside of school a lot. So I took ballet lessons from when I was 4 until 18. And that was really my sport, if you will. So my siblings got into sports in college, and Ballet was really my athletic.
So were they doing any kind of lessons?
My sister started with ballet and then moved to tap, but once she got into like middle school and high school, transitioned to sports at school.
Gotcha.
And then my brother just did soccer the whole time. And I did figure skating for a while too, which I guess is more properly considered a sport. But I have poor circulation in my feet, so that was a short-lived career. ballet was really the thing I think that more shaped sort of how I thought about like body and like aesthetics and music and performance and stuff like that. And it's been funny going on, like, later on. I have a lot of, like, the parallel or the simile that I reach for. It's like, oh, well, you know, in dancing. So I could see that it had sort of a long-term effect as well. But I did that, and then I did a lot of musical theater as well growing up. So I was involved in school, but those were also often things that were not centered in the school, but still involved a lot of training and learning and sometimes teaching little kids as well.
In either ballet and or in musical theater, were there any, did you perform either in your high school, any maybe memorable performances?
So in ballet we had a major performance every 2 years, and so I can remember the big one was when I was in eighth grade, because we were finally the big girls, right? So you got all the good roles. And that year we did Swan Lake, and I was a big swan, because even then I was like 6 feet tall. So ballet is very much about the aesthetics. So you can't be a big swan if you're not tall. Likewise, you can't be a petite swan if you're not one of the four smallest people. So, you know, like you... It's not always based on
there's
one
talent,
being the best.
But there are other factors.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, so I had gotten a lot better by that time, but it was really because I was tall. So that was definitely like the highlight of my ballet performance career, and then I did a number of things. So musical theater in high school, there was like we did Anne of Green Gables 1 year, and Cinderella another time. And then I did community theater, which usually performed at the Virginia Theater in Champaign-Urbana, which was a really cool performance venue. And so I was in... What was I in? Oklahoma. And I think I was in Cinderella again. And then Kiss Me, Kate was my senior year. My sister and I did that together. So,
and I guess you would have been a senior and she would have been a freshman? Four years apart?
In eighth grade. Yeah, okay. She would have been in eighth grade. So, but that was... My performance side of me had a lot of outlets in those.
Anything else that you maybe want to talk about growing up or your experiences in school? Or maybe we can transition to thinking and talking about teaching.
I think so, yeah. And sort of college and how that moved into it.
Yeah, absolutely. So... what brought you to study at Asbury College? And this is in Wilmore, Kentucky.
Yeah. So Asbury College is a Christian liberal arts college. And when I was looking at colleges, I was just looking at Christian colleges. So one of the common rhetorics in evangelical communities is that college is where you're going to lose your faith and it's going to like really test you, right? So I wasn't really looking for that. Not surprisingly, I was looking at places that would sort of encourage me in my faith. And added to that, I wanted to teach. And so I thought that it would be good to learn someplace where they would help me sort of see my students in a way that sort of came from my faith as well. So I was looking at places, and among evangelicals, Wheaton College is kind of considered the tippity top, right? That's where the really smart Christians go. Mm-hmm. And I was a smart Christian, so I should go there, right? and I even got in, but as I was comparing, I was looking at Asbury College because my pastor's oldest daughter had graduated from there in their education department. She was like, it's great, you'll love it. And in the end, it was the one I decided on. And it was intellectually challenging for me and all of that. But my reason for going there was that its motto was about holiness unto the Lord. And so when I looked at these two colleges and I was looking at my reasons, one was like, so I could be the smartest Christian kind of person, right? And the other one was so that I could really invest in becoming the kind of person that God wanted. Mm. And so that was the one I ended up choosing. And I loved Asbury. It was really good. Kentucky was a new experience for me. It definitely, I went there and I thought I was going to the South, right? Hmm. And then discovered that, like, Kentucky doesn't really see itself as South. Like, it's this, has this border mentality even still. But it was a pretty small college at the time. I'm trying to remember, I think it was like 1,400, 1,500. Mm. So pretty small classes, a lot bigger still than my high school, but possible to know almost everybody, which I did my sophomore year. It was my most social year. And it had a really great education department. Our professors were like involved with setting education policy in Frankfurt for the state, and involved in the area with how sort of education was being rolled out. So the way that they really sort of shaped how we saw education was looking at teachers as facilitators of student learning, right? And so it was very student-centric, and but I think good student-centric in the way that, like, we paid a lot of attention to how concepts were developed and how you would build skills, and and having students involved in their learning. I guess now the phrase active learning is super popular, but yeah, with those kinds of practical putting it into practice. And even then, it was very objective-based. Yeah, objective-based. So outcome-based as well. It was in the heyday of No Child Left Behind. Mm-hmm. So there were definitely these standards that you were supposed to be meeting. There was a lot of work into developing core curriculum so that everybody would be getting certain content standards. And then a lot of thought into how you analyze and assess whether they're doing it right. So there was, that was all a lot a part of the training that we got. And I think I remember after graduating saying, I don't think that it taught me to be a teacher. I already was a teacher, right? But but it taught me to work in the public school system, which is just so, if I hadn't had that, the learning curve for my first few years would have been so much higher. Just
because it's a very different skill set.
Yeah. And it's like a system that you have to learn how to work and exist in. Mm-hmm. So it did a really good job of helping me do that in a way that was more than just learning the system, but also learning sort of the reasons behind and how you how you do the teaching part through the system.
Hmm.
So yeah, I'm really happy with the training I got there. And the one thing that was different than I had expected when I went, I thought that I could do like a history major and an education minor.
Hmm.
Au contraire. Education definitely ruled the roost, and they had so many like requirements that when you were an education major, you didn't even get a ton of electives. So history was kind of a nice thing to pair with it because it was a very small major in comparison. People who tried to pair education with, say, music ed was the worst because they were both like huge, and so then you're trying to cram it all in. So I still felt like I was able to get a liberal arts education, but partly too, I took 9 semesters to do it. I minored in Spanish, and generally at the time, education majors didn't take a language, which is a little counterintuitive, but it was just that they had so many requirements. You couldn't do it in that time. But I wanted to get with a foreign language where I could actually speak it. And high school didn't quite do that for me. And so that also then freed me to be able to take more electives than some of my education friends were able to take, because I was taking an extra semester. And so I did women's choir most of my years, and I did theater tech and design, and what else? Those are the two ones I can remember. So, yeah.
And did you live on campus the first year, second year?
Yeah, so I lived in a dorm, the same dorm, all 4 years.
And was that mandatory?
Sort of. Dorms were mandatory. Like, senior year, you could apply to live in some houses that were, like, on the edges of campus or just off of campus.
But maybe not much incentive to...
Yeah, like, all my friends were still in the dorm.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And there weren't, like, freshman dorms. We had 2 guys' dorms and 2 girls' dorms. And so, dorm life was just... It was a really cool... I really liked it. Like, your hall had a lot of, like, hall spirit. And so you'd do things during the week that would be like all hall, you know, gatherings or dinners there would be these brother-sister hall outings where your RAs would pair up with one of the guys' hall dorms, one of their halls, and then go do something, whether it was putt-putt golfing or, you know, some activity. It was a really fun, fun experience that way too. Oh, I know what I was going to say.
Yeah.
So for history, we had 4 history profs. So it was kind of a small department.
In contrast to maybe how many education profs you mentioned, that was a much bigger department.
I feel like there was like 6 to 8.
Okay.
So, yeah. And oftentimes history or education people were like in and out a little bit more. So I remember some people who were like part-time and then they were doing things out. So... there was some that were really long-term established, but so that there was a little bit more a feeling of praxis, right? In history, there were 4 professors who had long been established, of thing. And there wasn't like, they weren't going out and coming back in and stuff like that. So, my favorite professor and my advisor was Dr. William McKinley. And he, in what was otherwise a fairly conservative department, he always said his favorite president was FDR, which I think he would still have said that he was on the more conservative side, but reflects a certain open-mindedness that was not displayed by everyone.
Did you say why?
He just felt like he had, like, tried things and had, like, seen a problem and attempted solutions, and solutions that were, like, aware of social problems, and so, like, motivated for that as well. Dr. McKinley was, and is, part of the Salvation Army, which is a church. So, like, they're very focused on that kind of social activism. And I think that's part of why he liked him a lot. But Dr. McKinley also actually got his PhD from UW-Madison, which I don't think I knew that until I started looking to apply here. He was like, oh, funny you should say.
from our department.
I believe so.
The history department.
Yeah.
Great.
Wow, so, cool. So yeah, it was a fun carryover there. But yeah, and I'm trying to think about education stuff. Oh, yeah.
Experiences in college and living in Kentucky.
Well, I lived in an area of Kentucky that's particularly gorgeous because there are a lot of horse, they're not called horse farms. What are they called?
Like ranches?
I guess. Like, there's all these, like, white fences basically on the green grass, and you have all the, like, the brown horses, right? It's just this lovely over the
estates,
the hills,
maybe something.
Yeah, I mean, there are some that could probably be considered estates, but mostly it's just these maybe like paddocks of sort of where horses are out grazing in the field. It's a very beautiful idyllic kind of air landscape. Wilmore is a little bit south of Lexington and it's pretty small. So anytime you drove to the big city, you're driving through this kind of landscape, right? So I was, in general in Wilmore, I didn't get super involved in Lexington until after I graduated and I taught in the area. So that definitely got me more involved in the larger community. And until then, I had gone to church in Lexington, so that was like once a week kind of thing. But then when I started teaching, I lived in Lexington. It's a university town. There's a number of universities there. So in some ways, it is more diverse than some areas of Kentucky. I remember there was a decently large Asian population, and there's a lot of Hispanic and African American communities as well. Some things about Southern culture other people like, and I did not. So one of those is I did not like politeness culture because I couldn't read it. I would rather somebody tell me to my face that they didn't like me or didn't agree with me. And then, like, I'm a big girl. I can take it. Right? But the, like, friendliness that I couldn't tell whether it was actual friendliness, I wasn't a fan of. So I guess I'm too Midwestern. I like a little bit more clarity. So I liked Kentucky, but when I moved back to the Midwest and to Wisconsin, I was like, I am home. This makes so much more sense to me. Yeah.
Anything else you want to add about your time in college?
Well, I guess on the lines of teaching, one other thing that I was a part of was there was a teacher's education fellowship, and I was like president of it for a while and vice president. And so that was a really cool thing that we had, where we got to sort of bring in speakers to tell us about things. One memorable one, we had a fashion show, where we like thought through the kind of clothes one would wear as a teacher and how students would see them. So, some of it was just like, when you're teaching high schoolers, you got to be a little bit more careful. But some of it too was like, thinking about the persona one wanted to create. So I remember reflecting, like, teachers who wear like more put together things, they come to class, they just seem like they're more put together. Students are more like there to learn, right? And it's been kind of fun to see some of the professors at the university like kind of come with their bow ties, or you know, with a similar, like, they're here to have their persona about them of learning and teaching. So that was something at the time that I remember thinking through and liking. And then the last thing about college that was pretty big deal was I didn't just take the theater tech and design class. I also did like some stage crew stuff for different performances, but I also choreographed the sophomore musical. So every year the sophomore class basically directed, produced, did all the things.
Like for the entire class, or just the people who were
interested? Anybody who
in
wanted to in the sophomore class, but not just drama people, right? Like people from every area. So I was education, I was doing things, and so it was really fun because you met a broad swath of people who were all just kind of interested in performing it. And because it's gone on for a while, everybody knew that your sophomore year was the year to participate in this, whether you ever did anything again or not. So it was my first attempt at choreography, and I did it with somebody else, but I kind of took the lead on it, I think. And we did Annie Get Your Gun, and so there's some like ballroom scene things in it, and it was so much fun, and it was a way of like getting a lot of people who didn't usually dance. Like, how do you teach them? How do you get them to look good on stage, feel confident performing? And it was such a fun experience. And when I went and taught high school, I rolled that into doing high school musical choreography as well. And so that's just was a way that I could sort of draw on my ballet training all those years ago.
Yeah. I wonder now, like a perfect transition, I think, to talking about teaching high school. How did you get into it? How does one move from a really robust education department to teaching high school in Lexington or around Lexington?
So Asbury was, I think it still is, pretty small. And so even though it had a really great education department, I knew that it was going to be people in the area, schools in the area where that degree had cachet, right? So I couldn't have gone back to Illinois and been like, guess where I graduated from? So in Kentucky, I decided I was going to teach there for at least a few years so I could get some lines on my CV and turn that over into experience quickly. So my ninth semester was the semester I student taught, and I student taught in Woodford County High School, Versailles, Kentucky, and it's a little bit northwest of Lexington. So I student taught there, and there's a lot of like paperwork that you have to do at the Board of Education, and I got to know the secretary, I make it a point to get to know secretaries. Mm. And so we were friends to a point, and then, you know, conversed. So one time I went in after my student teaching to like process papers and stuff. And she mentioned that, I hadn't even been, because I substitute taught then in the spring.
Hmm.
So I graduated technically December 2005. And then that spring, spring of 06 was when I was substitute teaching in Woodford County High School and the middle school and various middle schools and high schools around Lexington area. And,
were you teaching like all of every subject, whatever came
yeah
up? Okay.
Yeah. And in fact, I substituted for the teacher that I student taught for, and it went terribly.
Oh no.
Because they were on block schedules, and so all they get a whole new class the next semester. And I went into his classroom like I had some sort of authority because I'd taught the things before. And I had some major blowback from students. Oh, my word. So it was actually a little bit nice to be able to substitute in things that I didn't have a feeling of authority in already, because it allowed me to be slightly more hands-off, which students expect that from a substitute, right? They don't want a substitute coming in thinking that they are the teacher in the room. So, so yeah, I did math, I did science, I did special ed, which I don't have any skills in, but they were always happy to get somebody who was willing to substitute for that. And yeah, substituting in like a middle school math class, seventh grade math, I was like, I've got this. Which is probably like as far as my math skills are going to go. But it goes a good feeling of like, I know what I'm doing here with math. So yeah, that was that spring. And I went into the Board of Education in Woodford County. And the secretary was like, so I'm friends with this principal up in Scott County, which is further north, and they're looking for a history teacher who could also do Spanish. I know your resume. Can I give them your name? So I had been doing like interviews and all sorts of stuff myself at places, and I was like, yes, please, anything you want. So that was definitely at Scott County High School in Georgetown, Kentucky. It was the best interview that I had, and they gave the position to somebody else. So, and they were like, well, you know, maybe we'll call you back if something else opens up. But how many schools have multiple history positions open up in a year?
Yeah.
I gave up pretty quickly. So I got a job at Starbucks. I went on a trip to Indonesia for 2 weeks where I taught English teaching, like English education to teachers of English there. And then I came back and they said, surprise, we have a position, would you like it? So they had 4 of 9 teachers move to other things. They had 4 openings. It was crazy.
Wow.
So I wasn't their top one, but I was their top 4. So cha-ching, I got a position. And I taught world history for 3 years. And then a variety of social studies electives.
And did you get to conceive of your own curriculum or choose what those electives were?
So nope and nope. There were a number of people who taught world history, and so we all needed to kind of teach it similarly.
Got it.
And that was actually kind of nice coming in. I know people say that like standards-based classes or, you know, having these objectives that everybody follows is really confining for teachers. There's been a whole bunch of pushback. But for new teachers, it's really, really nice because when I started teaching, I was like 23, I think. right? And I was teaching world history from the Renaissance to modern day. Like, how can I figure out what to teach, right? So having a year plan that we kind of followed together, and then there were some people who had taught it before, and so they would share things, right? Probably the hardest thing my first year teaching was that we had, in general, it was the like 50-minute classes, but then over the lunch period, fourth hour was twice as long because they had to rotate all the students through the cafeteria. So you could have first lunch, second lunch, or third lunch, and then the rest of your class period otherwise. So that meant that whatever class was in the fourth hour was, if it was a year-long class, you did it all in a semester. And if it was a semester-long class, you did it all in 9 weeks. And so I was teaching three world histories, but two preps, one of the block classes and then the ones that were the full year long, but I had to do double time. And it's like playing a piano and you have to do the same melody, but one of them has to be twice as fast as the other. Mm. That first year I felt so bad because my block class, we got through World War II.
I mean, that's still pretty far.
I mean, it was into the 20th century. Yeah. But I was like, oh man, this is shameful.
It's going to be really disorienting.
Oh, yeah. It was so rough. And I just took too long at the beginning of the semester. Mm. But my year-long class, we got all the way through the Cold War, which had been my goal because in high school, I don't know how it was for you, but we never got past Vietnam. Mm-hmm. So I was like, must get through Cold War. So that was my sort of first year. And then every year I taught at least one elective. So I think that's James waking up. Civics, economics, arts and humanities, which was my favorite, and geography, which I also liked. Mm. And so it was kind of a wide range. They would just tell me, hey, you're doing this. And I didn't really have the ability to be like, I'm a crap teacher at this. Please put somebody else in. Because it was all about like scheduling and what worked for students. So, yeah.
Should we pause?
Let's.
Yeah, you got it.
Thank you.
Well, we're back with Joy. And now with James, who's woken up from his nap. He was napping very patiently and quietly during the first part of our conversation. He's back here with us for the second part. And I wonder... Joy, we were talking about your experiences teaching high school, and I wonder, you talked about teaching world history and teaching some electives. Is there anything else maybe you want to add about that experience? And I'm also curious about what your relationship with the other teachers and the faculty members were like. Mm. Some of them were really senior, but in the year that you came in, there were also some fresh junior faculty.
Yeah.
So what was that dynamic like?
Yeah. Well, first, I want to, for the record, I might have said the wrong name of my advisor in college because I'm just sort of talking as things come to my head. My advisor was Dr. Ed McKinley. Just wanted to make sure that I got that correct.
So we'll go back and make sure that, yeah, Ed McKinley,
yes.
Not any other potential McKinley.
So I guess first off, I was going to say for the various electives, I love teaching arts and humanities because cultural history, I think, gets really lost in a lot of teaching the high school sort of trajectory. Mostly it's politics, economics, and then society kind of in that order. Mm. And just that cultural history was really a fun thing to be able to do. I liked geography, but I had to do all of world geography in 9 weeks, which is just not fun. Mm. And economics, I had always loved learning about it, but I discovered I don't enjoy teaching it. It's really hard, and it doesn't come naturally to me. The worst, though, for me, was civics.
Huh.
Everybody else seems to love government, and I discovered that, like, so I grew up in Illinois, right? And I didn't really believe in the democratic process. Like, I think it's sort of a symbol of the control that either Chicago has on the state, or sort of these political infrastructures, like the partisan infrastructures have. But yeah, especially, I wasn't voting Democrat at the time, and so like, you don't exist, right, in Illinois if you aren't voting Democrat. So yeah, I got to teaching civics and I realized, I don't know that I believe some of these principles that I'm supposed to be rah-rah-rahing in civics class. And I hate, like, the conflict, right? And so politics for me at the time was just, like, people being entrenched in their perspectives and yelling at each other. And doing a debate with high school students leads one to think that that's definitely what politics is. Because nobody's thought these things through, and it's all just what their parents say anyway, right? Like, so, and I didn't have the ability to get students to rise above that in any way. So I hated it. And in fact, I told them that after teaching it once, and it was partly being forced to then have to do it again that made me realize I had just taken the GRE that summer. Not GRE, what is it? The thing for grad school.
Yeah, the GRE.
The GRE? Okay, yeah. So I just taken the GRE and I got exceptional scores on it. And then I turn around for the next semester and they give me the one course I said, never give this to me again. And I was just like, I have something to share with the world. And it is not here. They are not giving me an opportunity. So that was like a really big push for grad school. And we'll get into that later. But yeah, it's sort of funny how there can be those watersheds in a certain career. And civics was one of mine. So yeah, so there were nine teachers in total.
And
so
four of you were new that year.
Yeah. And one or two of them had been new like in the past 3 years before that. So it was a fairly young staff. You know, we came in bright-eyed and bushy-tailed as so many newbies do. I remember there was one guy who had been there for a while. He was kind of viewed as like curmudgeonly old guy, right? Who like did things old school. And so for a while I like knew him from afar. And then I got a room right next to him halfway through my time there. And I remember like being like, oh, well, we need to do things this way. And this is like the new wave of the future and the way students really learn. And he gave me this like world weary look, right? And was like, it's already come around before. Like, they're going to do tons of work on this. Nothing will change. The winds of education will change and they'll all go back to what it was before. And like, I should just keep doing the thing that I like and that I'm good at. And I remember at the time being like, wow, that's such a terrible like mentality. But further on this side, I understand a little bit more what he was getting at, that like he had found something that worked with his students and he was curmudgeonly, but there were students who flourished under him who never flourished under anybody else, right? And like he didn't have to be beloved by most of the students. They learned under him and they learned a new skill set under him as well. So yeah, that was, I think, it's funny now to look back at where I was then, but yeah, we were filled with a lot of enthusiasm and energy, which is always a fun sort of shot in the arm for a department. And three of the people who had left had moved on into different administrative things at the school. So yeah, history was kind of a significant group.
It had been agreed on that we wouldn't really give students homework in history because this was the era of trying to get math and English scores up. And so...
No Child Left Behind.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And so it had kind of been decided that that was where we wanted students to really focus on. And we did some, like, they would have some papers and stuff like that, but it wasn't... I guess AP classes were able to have a ton of reading and homework, but I just taught general history, and in fact, I sort of chose to do that because when we moved to AP classes, I let other people run with it, didn't try to take that ball at all, and there's just something about, like, getting a student who usually would get a D or an F, and getting them to where they can get a B or a C, that, like, that is more fulfilling than somebody who was gonna get an A anyway getting a better A. So, it's true, though, that I didn't get to deal with as much really, like, complex thinking, which I think took its toll on me over time. So yeah, we all kind of, there was a collaboration, so we collaborated on year plans when the exams were going to come, sort of the units that would be covered. We all started out world history with 2 weeks talking about world religions, because a few years before me, they had decided, even in Kentucky, the Bible Belt, people were coming and they didn't have any religious experience or knowledge. Sometimes they, even when they said they were a certain religion, they didn't really know anything about it, right? And so they wanted to get sort of these 2 weeks of having an overview, so that once we got into things, we could talk about, you know, in the Renaissance, Europe being Christendom, and people looking for old ancient Roman Greece, right? But then, like, going to the Muslim empires where they had, like, held on to everything, right? And so, there's all these things going on that you just kind of have to have some kind of religious awareness. And so that had been one thing that had been agreed on. We, like, talked about how to do that. So that was probably... Like, for arts and humanities, there was some debate about whether to go chronologically. We ended up deciding to do it, like, a unit on art, a unit on music, a unit on dance, and then within there sort of talk about things chronologically. Mostly because nobody had come up with the curriculum yet of putting all the things together. So that was our temporary thing while that got developed. So that was kind of how we worked together, and I have some really great friends. And
are you still in touch?
We're Facebook friends now, and partly just because grad school is a really different life than high school teaching, and so I've I remember I went back a number of times my first year here, and I started realizing how different grad school and the things that I was doing was from the things that I had been doing and they did every day. And so there was kind of talking at cross purposes, if you will. But probably my closest friend was the lady, well, she does French as her main thing, but then she also led all the drama. So I mentioned that I choreographed the high school musicals. So I did that my last 2 years. We did Once Upon a Mattress and what I came to consider my magnum opus, Seussical the Musical. Oh, man, I loved it. It had so much choreography. It was just like really had to be on my game with that. And yeah, the drama director, who's also the French teacher, and I... just became really good friends with that kind of collaboration, and you're working with students in kind of a more personal way. Drama is often a kind of home for a lot of students, right? As as many of the arts tend to be. And as like a classroom just can't be for students, right? So that was a, yeah, I really love that experience. And and it was a whole new set of kids who'd never really done dance before. And then trying to get them to like be comfortable moving their bodies in weird ways and you know, practice rhythm, but also just like enjoy the performative aspect. So yeah, that brought a lot of joy to my teaching time, each of the springs that we did it. And I'm trying to think. That was pretty much, I didn't coach any sports, which is the thing most people end up doing. But the choreography part was a really fun thing that I got to do.
So, you had mentioned in our prior off-tape conversation, and then also just now, that it was kind of in these moments that you were thinking about graduate school. You had taken the GRE and done really well. What was that process like? How did you begin to think about graduate school? What steps did you take, and how did that lead you to UW?
So in Kentucky, when you have a teaching license, it's only good. I could get a teaching license with just my BA in education. But by the time, 5 years in, in order to get it renewed, you have to have a certain number of graduate hours. And then at 10 years, you have to have gotten a master's degree. Usually, teachers will take master's level classes in some sort of education specialty. So it could be like gifted education or special education. Some people get into administration or library sciences or literacy, right? These are all a world of possibilities. I didn't want to do any of the education ones. I wanted to do history because I was like 23, 24, teaching all of world history from like a bachelor's in classes on it. Right? Like, it just seemed absurd to me that I was allowed to do this. And then I would continue, you know, for as long as I was teaching high school, not having any more history knowledge also seemed really like didn't work. So I said I wanted to have a quote serious history master's program. And as I was like casting it out for what would I then do it in, I realized I didn't want to do anything where Spanish was the language. Like, it just wasn't my interest. And so I was kind of stuck with doing the English-speaking world, which Great Britain went all over the place, so it still is pretty wide. But yeah, I needed to do some place where I could learn the local language while in grad school, because there was just no way I was going to be able to do it while I was teaching high school. And so I started looking at programs that let you do that, discovered about FLAS money. What does it stand for?
Foreign language and Area Studies.
Yes. And so I was looking at universities that made those kind of monies available. And so I had kind of narrowed it down to four that had South Asian programs. Oh, also I decided India.
Okay.
So
you have to tell us
weirdly,
about that.
Weirdly, like, for all of the thoughts that I give to so many things. When I tell a story about how I picked India.
Also going
to
play with the mic game in case I think I might have bumped that.
So
keep going.
When I think about how I got into India, it is the most off-the-cuff thing ever. because I basically was like, well, so like, what are big places of the world that are like world history, right? So I wasn't interested in U.S. at all. But then have a lot of British English speaking. And so I kind of had narrowed it down to India and South Africa. And I decided that India seemed like a more optimistic and upbeat place to study than South Africa. And I was like, yeah, and I would love Indian food, and I enjoy Bollywood movies and music. So like, I'm there, right? And so it was just kind of a weird... I had really not studied India much at all.
And you hadn't been there at that
point? No, yeah. I still haven't been there. Because I started this so late, right? Like, and then... So I'm casting about for what could I say to a graduate level department to make them be like, yeah, I think I have something to say on this, right? Mm-hmm. And so I was like, I mean, education is my game. It's what I know. So maybe if I like did missionary education in India, right? And so I like read a bunch of articles on this because I don't have time for full length books, right? Mm-hmm. So reading articles, I took fall break of my third year teaching. I had to both write the application and like read everything I could on missionary education in India, right?
You know, no big deal.
No big deal. Yeah, I still remember I was like sitting in a Starbucks for the whole week, right? And I guess I did not get into the other three places that I applied for. I only got into UW. And I found out later on, Andre Vink, who was the professor of South Asian history at the time, and who accepted me, what he really was looking for was somebody, because Dr. Robert Frickenberg had previously been in the department and now was a professor emeritus. And Andre Vink wanted a student that would help kind of keep him, Frickenberg, connected to the history department. So somebody who is interested in missionary education, right, which is like Frickenberg's wheelhouse, right,
yeah,
would be perfect. Unfortunately, I failed them both. Because I got here, and even though I still loved education, I realized I had... literally nothing to say to add to the conversation, right? Like, and part of it is like I got to know Dr. Frickenberg, and I mean, he was a missionary kid in India, so like, when compared with that, everything that I had to say was just like, you know, came from nowhere, right? So yeah, I ended up like bopping around trying to figure things out. Thankfully, Sana Iyer ended up coming to the department. So she was much more modern history, which is where I became interested in. But all that aside, they let me in. Whether they should have or not. And yeah, and I think things that that final year sort of affirmed the change for me as well. At the time, I had applied to the PhD program, but it was with the understanding that if I didn't like research, I could leave after my master's. Mm-hmm. Like, it wasn't... I didn't feel like I was committing to the PhD game. And I honestly had no idea if I would like graduate-level research. Before I came to graduate school, I had made the decision that I would never read another book that was more than 300 pages.
How has that worked out?
I had to eat those words pretty quick. but it was like, I don't have time for that in my non-academic life, right? And so yeah, it was a really big learning curve coming to graduate school after... having spent, I don't know, 7 years training myself to think like a high schooler and be interested in whatever the local pop culture stuff was, the recent stuff and the lingo. And then I got to graduate school and I didn't know any of the right words and I couldn't talk about anything appropriately. And Andre Vink does not really suffer... like, not just fools, but like people who aren't really serious, right? So yeah, I there was some friction. I didn't talk correctly and delve into things correctly. And I think too, I realized I just
Now I realize when you go to grad school, you're supposed to read the stuff for the advisor that you're going to work with. So you know whether this advisor is going to have anything that like you connect with or think the same about the world with. I remember I'm really into people, right? And Andre Vink is like not.
Yeah.
It's like these big systems, yeah. Right? Yeah. And I can remember having sort of an argument that was one-sided because he won it. But where I was like, but people matter. So,
and maybe if you're Akbar or Aurangzeb, you
matter. Yeah, yeah. But, so, you know, as I moved into modern history of South Asia, like looking at the history from below a little bit more, I think that was a lot more interesting to me. And now in my dissertation research, I'm looking at people who are kind of middling level, right? So in some ways elites because they were able to come to the U.S., but in the U.S., they're no longer really elites, right? And so but they're these really person-centered stories because that's what I like. Anyway, I've gotten far ahead of myself. But this is kind of how I came to UW and got started in the department. So I think one of your other questions was, what was it like when you came and what were some early experiences?
Yeah.
And so I'm one of the few people who taught my first semester in grad school.
Was that because you had so much experience
yes.
teaching already?
So part of it was, when I came, the department did not fully fund grad students.
Mm-hmm.
So in fact, when I came, I remember coming the spring before.
And this was 2009?
Yeah. Yeah, fall of 2009. And I remember talking to some TAs at the time, and they all said, you would probably have to pay for one semester out of pocket. But other than that, you could generally cobble things together, so plan on that. And that is exactly what happened. So I taught my first semester, and then I paid for my second semester, and then I got FLAS. And so once I got into that, then after 2 years of FLAS, I was able to get Comm Arts courses that I was teaching, and then I came back to the department and taught. So everything else after that was taken care of. But the first semester, part of it was for the funding. But a much bigger part was I was really afraid that I was going to miss teaching too much. I have always loved teaching. It's what gives me life. And I didn't leave teaching high school because I didn't like my students or I didn't like teaching them. So yeah, that was, I'm even now really glad I did it.
Are you getting born over here?
Yeah.
Okay. He might get a little bit louder because he's by the microphone.
And here's James joining us now at the table. So, and the FLAS grant that you got was for Hindi.
Right.
And so you had a little bit of a background in Spanish and had kind of maybe hoped to work with British sources, but yet, you know, realizing that if you're going to work in South Asia, you've got to have that language. So, what was it like learning Hindi?
So, I am not a language learner person. as I stumble over language. I'm pretty good with English, but it's almost like the better I've gotten at English, the worse I am at other languages, because it's so terrible to have to go back and to speak like a child again, right? And you have all these ideas that you don't know how to frame in other languages. So thankfully I'd done Spanish before, so I had some experience of that. And I'd even spent some time in Spain so that I got the experience of you know, total immersion kind of thing. So with Hindi, it was tricky because it's, I mean, so different than English or Spanish and the phrasing of it and the way parts function. And once again, I had never been to India and I, so that kind of intensive all around view wasn't really there for me. I did the summer intensive in Hindi at UW, Madison, which was really helpful just to spend that kind of time speaking it and hearing it. But it's also, it's not the same. Yeah. I'm fully aware of that.
I've also done that program in Disclosure, and I've also done the full immersion in country in Disclosure, and yes, can also say that.
They're different.
Yeah, they're different. But still an amazing that you have that resource.
Oh, yeah. It was really helpful. So I think the biggest takeaway from having done, I guess I did 2 years plus the summer immersion of Hindi, so it was basically like 3 years. And it enabled me to think very differently. So, because language is about conceptualization as much as anything else. And so, even though I'm like, can't really speak it very well now because it's been a while, but I still have the ability to conceptualize more the way sort of was trained by the language in that. One of the really helpful classes I took, which I almost failed this class.
Sometimes those are the best.
Yeah, it was amazingly, I really appreciate it, even though I did so terribly. Lalita Duperron taught a Brudge class.
Yeah.
And so it started out with like 2 grad students and 3 undergrads, and the 3 undergrads dropped it halfway through. And so it was just us 2 grad students, and the other grad student was a linguist. It wasn't even fair. So, but it was like learning Hindi, not learning Brudge by learning, what is it? It's Vaishnavic poetry and scripture and songs and all sorts of things. Like, that was so helpful. The tying the two together, right? To see, like, the language did this conceptual work. And the conceptual work, like, it got its life from the language, right? Like, it was just so tied in together. And when I have studied people who, you know, are practicing Hindus of various other kind of traditions, there's a kind of awareness of it that I just wouldn't, I think, have if I had done the study of Hinduism, you know, proper, the study of language outside of that.
There's this really rich cross-fertilization.
Yeah, so good. Oh, wait, I'm not going to put you by that PowerPoint. Just kidding. Yeah, so that was kind of my experience learning Hindi. Just for the tape, I suppose. I'm not sure if this came through on the bio, but I started, got my master's in South Asian history, and then with Sana Iyer. And then when Sana moved to, I think, MIT, I moved to study under Cindy Chang, and she does Asian American history. And so I kind of transitioned then too to do Asian American history, specializing in South Asians. And so now I study people who have come to the United States from India in like the 50s and 60s. Well, of course, the tricky thing is, they came from all over India. So Hindi doesn't help me really at all as a specific language for documents, right? Like, I should have also done Urdu and Punjabi and Telugu. So I just, you got to know your limits. And my limit was doing Hindi. So I have this like world view kind of thing, but I'm just, I know I'm not going to have all of the languages that would be most helpful. That's work for somebody else to do, right?
I also was thinking about, so Andre Vink, who you had worked with initially when you came to the program, as you mentioned, is very interested in economic systems of empire and, you know, large-scale, multi-hundred-year kind of narratives, whereas Cindy Chang is somebody who, like you, I think is much more interested in the quotidian, intimate histories of everyday people. And I wonder how maybe that transition also not only from South Asian history proper to Asian American history might also have been reflected in working with somebody who was a different kind of historian, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think it's really important. And this goes back to like who ends up being your advisor. When Sana Iyer came, I remember I was on the committee for like of graduate student advisors who got to see the different people who came. And the other person who was looking for the position was really into like document analysis, right? And I remember like that would have taken me a different direction if she had come. And Sana Iyer does Indians in Kenya. And so it's this very transnational view of Indians and of what Indians do acting looks like, right?
Yeah.
And so it's also very much looking at them in these other contexts. So so that transnational angle is Sana really enabled me to do that. And in fact, when I was looking for a master's thing, I kept trying to make education work. Because I love education. I love education documents. I like, give me those policy documents. And I don't know how many people in the world get like excited about them, but I do. So I really wanted to do something for like the time, early independence, Nehru era, right? Like, and I just couldn't make anything happen with it. And Sana was finally like, you like education, well, why don't you look at something that happened in the United States in 2005 and 06, but with Hindus and textbooks, go. And that was really helpful, because I don't think I would have looked at something in the United States if she hadn't pushed me towards it, right? But for her, that transnational angle, that was equally as legitimate as doing something centered on India. And it really was a great topic. It felt too political for me, because textbook controversies are really heated, and you got into Hindu nationalism, which can get really nasty. And so yeah, I switched to immigration because I thought it would be less political. Oh boy, naivete, right? I've finally been like, fine, I'm just going to embrace the politics and the strife and the conflict, whatever.
But if you have to do that anywhere, I mean, Wisconsin is a pretty good place to, to get that kind of training, those chops.
I think so, yeah. And some people feel like, I mean, I mentioned earlier that there's this kind of narrative among evangelicals that universities are out to attack your faith and blah, 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 blah. I have not found that to be the case. And partly I think it's because I started in South Asian history. Because when you study South Asia, being a person of faith is like expected. Like, of course you have a faith, right? It's not like, how dare you have faith and try to be an intellectual. It's like you have different kinds, right? So like that was welcome and okay. And it gave me training in both standing for like, hey, I have this perspective on these things and this like knowledge base, and also being willing to listen and not be on the defensive all the time, which is, I think, a way that people often interact with religious ideas and difference. So when I switched to U.S. history, there was a lot more antagonism towards Christianity and history. I mean, Christianity in the U.S. has been messed up with a lot of stuff, right? And mixed up with it. And so I understand why it's turned a lot of people off, right? But I didn't necessarily have to feel attacked when people were responding to the thing that they saw in history or in culture. And that really has made it so that, like, U.S. history also feels like home in a way that I hadn't anticipated. Yeah, and Cindy's focus on the quotidian, on these individual stories, on, like, an Asian American studies. You found your feet under the table.
Toes, yeah.
It's about, like, creating an archive, too, because there aren't usually archives of Asian American documents that we can go to. I remember some people on my dissertation committee were really pushing me to go to the National Archives to find stuff from a certain period on a certain thing. And I went there, and it was a terrible experience, right? Like, my people aren't in the National Archives in a way that, like, is findable. So instead you have to find all these other things. And one of my favorite archives that I've been able to discover is something that was in a grandson's basement. Right? Like, this is where we're sort of digging up,
like,
the
family
things
documents,
still.
Family yeah. materials.
And I love that Cindy is super supportive of that. Because it's what she had to do. And yeah, that really helps when you're with somebody who does the same kind of work you're interested in.
Yeah, absolutely.
So. I was going to say, because you had said early experiences in the classroom.
Yeah.
So my first class I taught was with Andre Vinks, and it was South Asian history, like, just beginning South Asian history. And I remember, so I had four sections. Oh, let's see if we can get you to quiet down. It was four sections, one of which was a FIG. So these are a freshman interest group. And man, those freshmen were better than all the other students because they're all, like, gung-ho and so excited about it. So that was a fun... having a FIG my first semester. It was tricky, though, because Andre, he was not trained in the same school of education that I was, would probably be the way to put it. And so there were all sorts of things that he would do. Like, I wouldn't know how he wanted to cover a topic. And then we'd get to the exam, and there'd be questions that, like, I hadn't taught, right? And as somebody who did a lot of training for objectives, and you do the backwards learning where you know what you want to assess, and so you make sure you teach that kind of thing, it drove me crazy, right? And I don't think I responded very well to that because I had a lot of, I felt like I knew all about teaching. We'll just put it that way, right? The pride of, I don't know if it was youth, but, and so yeah, I think that was a really hard teaching experience for me. And it's taken some time out of that to appreciate, more some of those older styles of teaching, and appreciating the lecture, right? As a thing, right? I still don't know that I'm going to be able to lecture well, just because that's been zero part of my training. And yet this ability to do that, to put all the information together and really propose these big picture arguments and stories is really a skill and really helpful. So yeah, my appreciation for Andre's teaching style has changed over time. But I just remember that first semester. I came in like, I know what I'm doing with education. And then, like, the university did it differently. And it was so frustrating. So, yeah. I'm trying to remember what else comes next.
Yeah, anything else that you or James want to add about that, you know, that I suppose, the department and teaching mm-hmm. and just experiences in that first year or two or around your shift in project and emphasis.
Yeah.
Before we start talking about Act 10.
Yeah. The shift from South Asian history to Asian American history was remarkably difficult because the way that the department is set up, those are like completely different fields. I had to apply to the history department a second time.
Oh, wow.
To switch to a different field because they don't have, at least at the time, they didn't really have a way to go across that very well. But I do have to say, Leslie Abadie, like, she makes things happen, which is amazing. It was a time Cindy sort of pulled some strings with Colleen Dunlavy, who is the director of graduate studies at the time. So even though I had been here for 4 years, was how long my master's took, they started my clock anew, like I was coming in. So that wouldn't be counted against me, because that was also back at the time that you didn't have to do a master's in 2 years.
Uh-huh.
And it changed basically right after. Or maybe even right as, but I had come under a different thing. So it was even tricky, because they've changed so much in the department since I came.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be that your master's thesis was like 100 to 200 pages.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's what, like 30 to 50?
The ideal standard is 35, I think, last time I looked at it.
So I had been able to make a deal with my advisor that I could do, I think mine was like 88 or something like that. It was two chapters.
Uh-huh.
Because I had been here 4 years. I had gone out to California to do research. So it was... I'd done a lot more. It wasn't just like a paper for a class, which I think is what a lot sort of that's the length that they've
you
done.
Sort of take a substantive seminar paper and beef it up after that.
I had like been doing original research and stuff for mine, and so I was like, please let me make something out of this. Switching, I ended up doing a completely different topic once I got into U.S. history. Partly I had to take all new classes because I hadn't taken my prelims by the time Sana left. And so I needed to prelim in U.S. history.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, they didn't want to just give me prelims on things I'd never studied before. So I had a whole year to like get all of U.S. history classes in after... I mean, it had been
That's a pretty tall order itself.
It had been since undergrad that I had studied U.S. history, right? Like, I was a world history person. So, that was a weird switch. The fields do things differently. So, I don't know that I ever did a book review in South Asian history. And I did, like, 10 book reviews my first semester U.S. history classes. It was really kind of funny what a big switch it was. I think there have been some benefits to the changes the department has gone in. But I also think that, like, I would not have been able to get my master's in 2 years, right? Like, I was coming from ground zero, basically, right? And I had to learn Hindi, and that took me 2 years just doing that. And I was doing classes for a year before Sana came, and that was kind of just feeling things out too. So it wasn't like I didn't have any of the things to switch around and write a thesis in 2 years and, you know, pass a 2 year, whatever. So I can appreciate why they want people to get through more like that now. But I also know it means that people like me can't do that in our department, right? And, like, I guess you get your master's someplace else, and once you figure things out, you come to UW.
Yeah.
can get you a pacifier.
Hopefully what I can, I've been saying has been still able to be heard.
So this is 2009, 2010. Mm-hmm. What was, you know, the political and social climate like coming to Madison on this campus with its own history of, you know, really robust activism? Mm-hmm. At that time, kind of leading into Scott Walker's election. Mm-hmm. And that was, he was elected in 2010, if I remember.
I think, or was it he 11? Might have been... Yeah, was it 2010 and then he started in 2011?
I think, and then Act 10 like, started
everything
in early 2011.
Crazy happened in February. So, as a sort of like background, my placement in terms of my politics is probably valuable to know like my perspective on things, right? So I'm kind of was a conservative from Illinois, right? Mm. So when I was in Kentucky, I remember students thinking I must be a Democrat because I'm so liberal. makes me laugh. And in Madison, I still think I'm probably more conservative, or at least I see myself as a moderate, especially the direction that the conservatives have gone so far in the last 10 years. But it means that I'm not, like, I'm definitely not a progressive, right? Even when I appreciate a lot of progressive things, I still wouldn't call myself a progressive. So when I was teaching high school, I was a part of the, what is it, National Education Association, NEA, which is a union, mostly because people sue teachers for stupid stuff, and I wanted some backing so that that wouldn't happen to me. But I also sort of come from a tradition of questioning things that unions do, right? Of unions often, in practicing solidarity with lots of different groups, they often are pushing things that don't have anything to do with the job that people are doing, right? And so conservatives are often really frustrated by that. And I would say I too can be frustrated by that, right? But I also study history. And I know that unions are super important, right? And that business or managers or whatnot have really different interests. And so if it's only their interests that are running the stage, workers will probably get screwed. Not because, like, people in power are necessarily bad guys, but just, like, they've got different interests, right? And so you need to have all of those at the table. So that's sort of how my perspective looks at things. And when I came, I remember, like, the TAA, the Teachers Assistance Association. Was really active, and they were, you know, pushing a lot of things, many of which I didn't really see the point of. So at the time, when I arrived that first year, they really wanted to get rid of seg fees. And I remember being like, I mean, I get why we have to pay seg fees. Like, we're using a bunch of services on campus, like... I can't remember what it was at the time, but it was a lot less than it is now. And it was like, this makes sense. I really appreciate, like, bus passes and things like that, access to the sports, athletic, workout facilities, things like that. And so I kind of felt like the TAA was pushing beyond where it needed to be, and I was happy with what things were for me at the time, right? But everybody was a part of the TAA, whether you wanted to be or not, if you were a TA. So now my roommate at the time, was my best friend since third grade. She lived here, was a nurse at UW Hospital.
And so Walker's threat and then passage of getting rid of union rights did not just affect the teaching assistants, it affected mm-hmm. everybody, mm-hmm. right? That is a part of a state union-based thing. And so I learned things from her about what were benefits that nurses had really fought for in their mm-hmm. union. One of which was that you didn't have to, you didn't have to work more than a 12-hour shift in a row, mm. or once your 12-hour shift was done, if the person didn't come to relieve you, you could still leave. Mm. And it wasn't your responsibility to find somebody. The hospital had to find somebody to cover you. Because otherwise, like, nurses were working days at a time, right? And so I sort of understood from her how important some of the protections that unions were giving their workers were. And as I said, I really do think that workers should be allowed to bargain as unions. So that I was super against. if that doesn't come across here.
Yeah.
And so I wasn't against Walker, like, out of hand because, mm-hmm. like, he wasn't a progressive, right? Like, mm-hmm. I, that wouldn't have been an issue so much for me. But I remember in his campaign, I realized I see the working class as also being part of the middle class, mm. right? So I don't really separate them in, like, I know they do different jobs, right? But they don't, in my mind, need to be antagonistic towards one another. Mm. They're not don't need to be in competition. And partly it's because, like, my maternal grandfather was a construction worker, right? And so I have, like, working class is my family too, mm. right? And a lot of my family moved up economically into, I think, what would probably be called the middle class. But it's not like they were trying to leave something behind that they hated or that was wrongheaded or selfish or, you know, any of those things that are words that describe economic competition between classes, right? Uh-huh. So when Walker was talking about the middle class, initially I was thinking he meant the whole of the people in the middle, right? Like, not the poor, not the elites, but, like, all the other people, right? And then as I started to pay attention to these, like, divisions that he was describing and who he was pointing at saying they're greedy, you know, let's not, he was, you know, striking this line between the middle class and the workers. And what's, of course, weird in the university is that there's all these workers who are tech, like, middle class, right? Like, TAs are workers, and we're working for fairly low wages. But most people have grown up in the middle class. They mm-hmm. have these kind of perspectives and, like, experiences, and they're just not a strong divide.
Mm-hmm.
And so it sort of demonstrated how weird, and this was like teachers' unions, right? And like postal workers and like all these kind of people who work for the government. It didn't make any sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something that really made me say, you don't have the right idea mm. of how society functions. Mm. And so I don't think you're going to have good policies for it either. Mm. And I think that his time in office played out who he was giving things to and taking things away from pretty clearly. So that was kind of the lead up to what happened. So
I mean, the Wisconsin budget repair bill, was that the one that where they were like, let's take away union staff?
Yeah, I think that was the formal name of what's okay. often referred to as Act 10.
Yeah. I think they're one and so, the same. Part of the other problem was that Walker came in being like, I'm just going to push this through. I don't have to have anybody really support me as long as I have the legislators who will back whatever my play is. And so he, with all sorts of speed, tried to make things happen. And I would say kind of do away with what are the democratic forms of governance that we have and trying to push what was more through a kind of shaped oligarchy, if you can, right? Like having just pissed guys with enough power to be able to push more whatever they wanted. So was this also the time when the Democratic legislatures like left to slow things down so they couldn't vote?
Yeah, I mean,
or was
that
later?
I wasn't here yet and wasn't super politically conscious about Wisconsin, but I do understand that, you know, his election also kind of right came on this wave of like, he had a lot of support in the state. So I think a lot of state seats might have flipped.
He had the power in, like, of the people who were elected, there were Republicans, so they would back whatever his play legislatively was, right? But part of the legislative process is that you also let the public know so they can talk to their representatives, right? Because it's not just a partisan thing. We're not just like, how many Republicans do I have on my side? Check, right? They're actually representing a populace. Mm-hmm. And so, so in trying to go super fast, he was taking away all of the ability for them to hear from a populace and then represent them. Mm-hmm. And perhaps things would have gone the same way if he had gone slowly. I don't know. But it was the failure to follow the democratic process because he wanted his policies so much. Right, like that's what it was. And so obviously I had a problem with the speed of it, and I also had a problem with the policies. But there was this whole uproar as people started learning about this, and there were all these attempts to slow down the process. And I think this was when a bunch of the Democratic legislators left the state so they couldn't vote on things, right?
Yes,
this is where,
that
like,
happened in
I've been here for so
March,
long, I don't
February,
know what shenanigans
March.
Have happened.
Mm.
So, the media of the nation, right? There's all these things that are being talked about. It was like on the Daily Show and the Nightly Show and all the news shows. And of course, Fox covered it a ton. Well, on Facebook, I have a lot of friends who are pretty conservative. And so part of how I live on Facebook is that I try to give a different side of things. So one, they can actually see liberal things for what I would say that they are, rather than being turned off automatically by whatever words are being used. There's, you know, the two sides of politics right now do not converse because they're like not talking the same language or any of that. So I'm kind of trying to get over that. But part of it was also being like, Fox is lying to you. That is not happening here. I was there. And I had friends who were not my friends for a little while because they told me that I didn't know what I was talking about and that Fox obviously knew what they were talking about. And I was like, I am literally a witness of this. Why would you listen to people who are not witnesses of this? So this was like, I did go to a few protests,
But I'm not really a protest person, in fairness. And after February, when things died down a little bit more, I was interested in seeing how anti-Walker people were able to spread out the feeling more than just Madison. Because, right, like, Madison's just obviously not going to support such a conservative governor. But part of it was, like, will progressives be able to take this message to the larger state? And there was some that they were able to encourage people to vote against him when he came for, what was it called? There was the, like, it wasn't his normal term, but they... Not impeached. Like, what was it? They had a whole other halftime vote.
When they tried to recall him.
That was it. How could I forget that word? It was everywhere. so, yeah, I wanted to see whether they could get the state to recall Walker.
Yeah.
And I wasn't really a part of that at all. I was a little bit more watch and see. And, and they didn't, right? And I think partly because... A lot of people were like, he got elected for 4 years. He should be allowed to do that.
We can probably unplug this. I think there's, ample battery if that makes it easier and safer.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, my power cord's there, too.
Oh, yeah. We've got full battery on there.
Oh, excellent. Okay.
Can make some more room for him.
Yeah. You're just rolling around.
So obviously the TAA.
So that was the politics things.
The TAA was, like one of the stakeholders in the campus community, definitely at the forefront of the protests. And, I know the department now, and I imagine then, had a lot of strong representation in the TAA. What was, the climate like, or discussions or conversations amongst TA members, outside of, did you talk to faculty members? Did you talk to Leslie Abadie? Did you have conversations about how it was affecting, life and relationships within history?
Oh, I don't actually remember that. That's so weird. I know that, professors would, either when there were some, protests going on, they, wouldn't have class, or they would encourage people to go to them, or they'd have class off campus so that TAs could go to things, and then they would.
So there was some solidarity.
So yeah, I felt like there was a lot of solidarity that faculty had for what the sort of interests and fears that TAs had. And I think they even might have written something up where they were like, this is stupid, don't do it. Of course, more academic than that. But UW's history department has been very politically active, and they're really not afraid of calling things out. Now I just can't remember what things were. I think this might have been the time when Bill Cronin was publicly saying that what was going on was wrong, and then. It had to have been around this time that, I can't remember if it was the state executive branch someplace, or if they were legislators, but then they, somebody called for, all of Cronin's email records.
Yeah, there was a Freedom of Information request for some of his email correspondence.
That they would have everything related to X number of topics, which was obviously they were trying to dig up dirt on him and show that he was, I don't know, some terrible radical or something. But of course, one, he's smart and he didn't put stupid things in public email. and two, then there was all of these are with students and have private information. you shouldn't be allowed to ask for these mm-hmm. because then that violates student privacy.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just a really, like, feeling of being attacked. There was a lot of antagonism between the state and the university, or even it felt kind of the population of the state and the university,
yeah.
right? Like Walker's rhetoric of university people as being, you know, in these unions, the same sort of like greedy, they, you know, just are looking out for themselves
mm-hmm.
kind of language. The same ones that he used for the teachers in the state,
mm-hmm.
right? Like really set those groups, it felt mm-hmm. like, against the populace who seemed to support Walker. And so one of the things that that did is it actually inspired a lot of sort of, I guess I'd say, public history. People writing articles in newspapers. You know, people were from Milwaukee, like doing it in Milwaukee papers or whatnot. There was sort of an engagement that was happening where people were like, oh, shoot, have we become too ivory tower? Right? And being able to get this word out. So I thought that was really, I mean, you don't want those kinds of things to happen, but kind of a good thing that occurred out of it. I think even though what Walker did crippled the TAA at the time, right? Like, they lost so many people because you had to buy in. And I was one of the people who didn't buy in right away because I wanted to see, like, what were they going to do, right? I had these kind of questions before about the interests that they were committed to and were working for, right? So I wanted to see, were they going to, like, get into things that I thought were really our stuff, right? I should, for the record, say I am now totally in favor of getting rid of said fees. Mostly because the university has pulled several really shitty things on us. Like when they got all of the undergrads to vote for an entire renovation of the athletic.
Oh, the surf.
The surf.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they proposed it so that none of the undergrads voting would ever have to pay for it in increased STEG fees, right? But it was all the grad students who were going to have to, right?
Mm.
So those are just now sort of kicking in. And yeah, it's, if STEG fees were actually used for the things that grad students then participate in and get benefits from, I still think they would probably be, it would be a valid thing for us to have to pay them. But at this point, they're just using them to, as a side way to get money from people. And so, yeah, grad students are legitimate workers on campus, and we shouldn't have to pay for stupid things like that. That is my opinion. Go TAA. So now, like, I've become a really big fan of the TAA because I think I've just seen them grow in who they are reaching out to, who they are trying to work for the rights and benefits of, and it's not just teaching assistants now, it's like graduate workers in general. And even right now they did a lot of work asking people, what are the things that you are concerned about? And so we're concerned about international student or worker fees, right? And these are things that, like, they did really good work in the last, what was it, would it be 7-8 years? And there's a lot more energy behind it now than there used to be. So Walker bad, some of the things that it pushed us to do, kind of good.
Yeah, that's interesting. And a nice bit of optimism, I suppose.
Yeah. I am probably more optimistic than I need to be, but yeah.
So we've talked a little bit about changes in on campus and in the department, and and certainly ways that the TAA has adapted in the post Act 10. What about your sense, you know, we're not just academics, we live in this city and in this county and in the state, and you've talked a little bit about the state. What about, you know, experiences in Madison more generally as climate or relationships with neighbors or friends shifted after that moment, that period?
So I've gone to church the whole time I'm a Christian church the whole time I've been here, and at first I went to High Point Christian Church, and then when I married Stephen, we go to his church, which is Lake Trails Presbyterian Church. So and I think evangelical Christian churches have a lot of, my guess is, a lot of the conservatives in Madison go to them, right? Yeah. Like, there are also very liberal churches in Madison, but I have a feeling that, yeah, if you're looking for conservatives, that's a good place to find them in Madison, which is,
that would be my guess, right?
Like, that Madison's not known for its conservative population.
But of course they're here. They're,
oh, absolutely. Yeah. So I think one of the things I found interesting when I first got here, and it still continues, is how, what's the word? Besieged conservatives feel here in Madison. And so with Walker, they often felt like, finally, we have this voice. We, you know, have, we're not perpetually besieged by others now. Now, it was very weird to me because when I came to Madison, as I said, I didn't feel attacked or besieged. And there are a lot of progressive elements that I'm really open to. So perhaps that's why I don't feel besieged by it. But yeah, so that was a hard thing for me to, I guess, like, not process, but like, it just seemed like it was not connected with my experience in Madison. And I'm not sure, maybe if I live here a lot longer, I would feel that, but it could also just be like the way one lives in the city, that like I don't live in the city in the same ways that some other people do, sure. Right? I mean, I definitely would say I live in Madison, so it's not more the method or the modes of participation. So yeah, so one of the, so on sort of like a topic like race, right, which has a lot of political valences and demonstrates how it is a topic that kind of pervades a lot of other conversations, right? So before I came to grad school, I was definitely aware of like racial issues, right? But I think I often felt on the defensive about them, being not just white, evangelical, middle class, all the rest of it, right? And my family's been in the United States for a very long time. So yeah, like all the problems that go with race in the U.S., we've probably been participated in them at some point, right? And so I remember always feeling like I didn't know if African Americans would be looking at me weird or reading something weird into things, right? And so that this like being on the defensive, right? I remember being more like that. So studying India was really helpful because I got to study all of these things from the perspective of an outsider.
Mm-hmm.
I just, like, I'm not even remotely culpable. Mm-hmm. Right? And so I was able to appreciate a lot of nuances, learn how to discuss things. And so when I started looking at race and class and ethnicity in the U.S., I feel like I had a much better way of addressing it and being able to reflect on ways that I am a part of the problem, but also not need to be defensive about that. And some of it is, like, really real practical ways, right? When we looked for a house here in Madison, Madison's really segregated.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, what do you do? Here, we're pregnant with a kid, right? And we're like, oh, yeah, we need more space. We used to live on Sheboygan Avenue in the Monticello apartments there. It's a great area, really easy bus access to campus. Some of the most expensive areas in Madison. Super white, super Asian, right? Like, when you look at the racial distribution, it has great schools.
Yeah.
So we have a kid, like, what schools do you go pick, right? Now, these schools in this area don't get very good ratings. And then the question is, like, well, what are we going to do? Are we going to choose to pick a neighborhood that looks really not strong on paper? We don't have time to go look into, like, why it doesn't look strong on paper. It turns out it's a lot more economically and racially diverse here. Mm-hmm. And so, like, I know that one is not supposed to, like, sacrifice one's kids on the altar of social activism, right? But then again, it does matter, right? Because these are all the daily things that you choose that helps confirm segregation in the city, helps confirm the resources going to areas that are racially discriminated. Discriminatory spending, right?
Yeah.
And so, like, yeah, like, those are things that are really, I'm glad I can wrestle with now. Mm-hmm. And I think that studying Asian American history has helped me be able to wrestle with those things. And yeah, and now that we, like, living in Madison, I think you need to wrestle with those kinds of issues. And I know a lot of people who would prefer not to. And yeah, I don't really know that I have a conclusion for that. but that's, like, that's part of the living in Madison and how my research and intellectual thinking influences my kind of daily things or daily politics.
I think that's such a wonderful segue kind of toward where I wanted to head maybe next, but you've sort of also maybe already answered it a little bit. But so I'm gonna ask the question maybe by way of thinking about the history department. We've talked about the kinds of pedagogical and political climate, but then you know, it was an incredibly supportive place for your shift in choice of study, but also, is it a really supportive place to have these kinds of ethical conversations or this sort of wrestling, you know, are you getting support for, or is, you know, maybe you could even think about answering it, like, how, maybe what are some of the ways in which your study of Asian American history has opened up the space for you to have these moments of tension, to think about these decisions, how to be a citizen in new kinds of ways?
Yeah. Well, so Asian American history is an interesting field in that Asian Americans are kind of, we usually think of race in the U.S. as black and white, right?
Mm-hmm.
And or people of color versus white. And Asians are tricky because oftentimes they kind of join in with white culture and white class and white politics. But then they also have these weird exclusions, right? I mean, there's this whole history of Asian exclusion in the U.S. And even today, there are ways that they'll be like, wait a second, I've hit a glass ceiling kind of thing. Mm. And I didn't realize that I might. I mean, you have the whole push to get rid of affirmative action in universities by Asians who
mm-hmm.
say, this is actually hurting us
mm-hmm.
because if we were on a different playing field, we could soar.
This is the argument in like the Harvard admission scandal
exactly,
a few years ago.
Exactly,
yeah.
Yeah. So like they're just in a really interesting, and I know scholars of South Asian studies talk about this like triangulation of race
mm-hmm.
where they kind of sound out the depths of where racial things go, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that makes for really interesting conversations because there's an awareness that you can both be hurt by the racial hierarchies and benefit by it,
mm.
right? And so it's not like there are people who are just... I mean, I'm sure there are people who just always get the good things, right? Mm. But there's just so much more nuance. And I think sometimes one of the reasons why white people feel like so attacked by racial conversations or conversations about race is that they'll say, but I didn't have every benefit, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're acting like
mm-hmm.
I had all the good things and you had all the bad things, and that just doesn't play out,
mm-hmm.
right? And so I think Asian American studies offers a way to explore that nuance without letting you off the hook,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, yeah, there are really crappy things that happen to you, but that doesn't mean that you get to then walk all over blacks in your attempt to
mm.
rise up to whiteness standards,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And so this is that... I've really appreciated that in my own development, and I think I try to use it when I talk with people as well, so that I don't have to come across like... boom, you're racist, right? but also challenge people to reflect on how they are participating in things. Sometimes they really want to and reinforce those hierarchies, and sometimes
mm-hmm.
it's unintentional. So yeah. So I think that's how Asian American studies has been helpful for that. And I think Cindy has been really helpful. I know some people in Asian American studies are really like, they really push their activism, and they have, I would say, kind of black and white categories of whether you're with us or against us.
Mm.
Right, that kind of, and I'm really thankful that Cindy's not like that, because
mm-hmm.
as I said, in Madison I can seem conservative. I'm a moderate, right? But moderates always then get either one side or the other, whichever you're not. And Cindy lets me be that moderate,
mm-hmm.
And she's not gonna like accept faulty thinking or injustice or, you know, those kinds of things, right? But she also is okay with me working things out. And yeah, for instance, in my own research, I keep finding these people who are South Asians and participating in the university, and they can't remember
experiences of being excluded or that their race is a problem. And I read things by African Americans who say universities are a prime spot of racial exclusion. And there are ways that South Asians are excluded at the university, but like for many of them, especially in the 50s and 60s, the university is like this bubble of people not excluding them, right? And so Cindy lets me explore something like that without being like, oh no, this is going to like lead you down trails that will further whatever terrible thing. So I've been appreciative of that a lot. So I found it really a helpful place to do thinking and work.
I guess anything else that you want to add about your experience in the department or at the UW in the last few years before we maybe transition to our last question or two?
Yeah. So I had a lot of really positive things to say about TAA, but there is something that I would like to say on record for history. And that's been, it's been really interesting to have a spouse who, so Stephen graduated from UW as a graduate student, and now he is academic staff, and so he sees sort of the academic staff and faculty perspective on things, and I think it's interesting because we've done a lot of reflecting. Faculty and staff often get really frustrated at TAA because the TAA only always pushes for graduate student rights, but often without thinking about how they interact with a larger system. And I have been really impressed looking at the chemistry department, how much the department, like administration and teachers, really think about students as workers and how to be fair and thoughtful to them. I know like Stephen and his colleagues in general chemistry do so much to keep work hours down. And here the department has gone through this thing called REACH, which is basically turning, what do they call it? I wrote it down here, I don't really forget it. They're redesigning learning for active learning in high enrollment classes. So basically they're trying to like flip so that you aren't doing as much lecture and you're doing more processing questions and stuff in class, and students are doing more of the learning specific content outside lecture. So like that has just ballooned the amount of work that instructors and TAs have to do. And they've been really thoughtful about keeping those hours down, which usually means that faculty and staff take on all the extra hours because higher ups have determined that this is the best course of, development. So like, sometimes I feel that TAA, because we're always just all the same age, right? Like, we haven't been the staff, we haven't been the faculty, and you always get a new crop, right? Who hasn't been the staff and hasn't been the faculty. And so there's often this like failure to work with people that I think like the lower down administration of departments aren't necessarily our enemies, right? Like, we aren't necessarily in conflict, or we don't need to be in conflict with them. And if we want them to take our considerations seriously, I think we often need to take their considerations seriously too, because they're like dealing with a whole bunch of different considerations as well for teaching and work hours and like doing this job that we do. And it can become what TIA does can become so much like against the top brass that we forget about those people that we could really like work with. So that would be my for posterity.
Yeah.
I don't know that anybody from TAA will ever listen to this, but I feel like I want it to be said because I wouldn't have known that if I didn't have a spouse who had gone through the grad student experience here and now could see it from the other side. And as I've been here longer and sort of moved into that participating in certain kinds of administration and department stuff, I can see that now too. Like, there's a lot of other things going on. And we do want to protect ourselves as workers, but it's in this other system we have to figure out how to be a part of too. So that would be my takeaway, the thing that I wanted to say.
Yeah, great. I guess the last question that I want to ask is maybe to try and bring this full circle a little bit, and especially as James is here with us and growing ever less patient by the moment, though he being a real trooper. How has becoming a mom changed how you think about education? Just super broad question.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if it has yet. Because I think... like, I did a lot of human growth and development and stuff like that. And so I find a lot of the things, like, when I read a parent training or, like, training your kids kind of book, I'll be like, oh, yeah, well, that's X theory. Right? Like, so it's, those things have held in really good stead so far.
Mm.
I think one of the things that's been surprising to me as a mom is just how much humans have to learn. Like,
yeah.
Like, it's stuff like James is bad at eating, right? Like, how are you bad at such a basic thing? He's bad at digesting breast milk. Like, this, we're mammals, people. Like, this should not be so hard, right? Or, just like every little thing that... that humans don't, like, when they're born and you can't see very far, right? And then there's this moment when you can see far enough that you can, like, see faces.
Mm.
And then there's another moment when you can, like, see outside of a window, right? Like, this is just wild to me. And even though I took these classes, I just didn't know this stuff. So that's, I don't know how that's gonna change me as a teacher, right? But... it's kind of a new level, and I really like that. But I also think, like, the whole you gotta teach them everything is probably a pretty good takeaway message. I know when I teach freshmen, I do a lot of things that a lot of other people don't do because I taught high school, and so I know what they're coming in with, or more properly, what they're not coming in with. I always give this mini lecture, I mean, like, 2 minutes, right? About how they need to own a stapler, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because they're going to come to class and teachers and TAs don't have staplers on their desk.
Yeah.
Right?
And the library sure doesn't.
Yeah, and the library doesn't, right? So it's like, own a stapler.
Yeah.
Nobody tells them
that
that's, like, a part of growing up in the college student. And then all these TAs are frustrated in the TA rooms about these students who, like, randomly tape things together or fold the corners, right? And, like, why can't they just staple it? They literally did not know. And for some reason, they've turned in 3 papers and it has still never struck them how other people are turning in ones with staples. And I think that kind of points to, like, we really do need to learn all these little things, and they don't just come to us. So yeah, being aware, I think I have more grace for students when I remember that. So yeah, we'll see how it changes me long term, but that'd be my first takeaway. 9 months in.
Yeah.
Well, anything else about this, about, you know, anything you want to add today? We've covered a lot of ground.
Yeah, well, and it's been so much fun to talk about things, experiences I've had and things I've thought. So thank you for that opportunity.
Yeah, it's been wonderful talking with you. We've been colleagues in the department for a few years now, but to learn quite a bit more about your own history and experiences has similarly been great for me. So I guess we'll shut it off now and let the Insexers go to work on it and maybe pick up again in you know, once travels and things are calmed down here.
Sounds
in the next few
good.
Months.
Thanks so much.